I'm going to now share screen and go over to my PowerPoint. Okay. Okay, great. So at this point, I can't see what you all are saying. Sorry about that. I can only see my PowerPoint screen. So for those of you who came in a little later, I'm going to start the class now. And I'm going to go for probably around an hour and 20 minutes or so, an hour and 15. We're going to do 2 weeks of classes. The PowerPoint is available. If you look under the files, I believe it is, you can get the PowerPoint. I'll upload it at my website as well. I'll also put the audio at my website, and I believe Paul will make the video available through Webinar Jam. Okay? So anyway, if you have questions, you can put them in the chat now, be fine, but I won't get them till the end of the class. So I'm going to start right there. So our topic is essentially science in the Bible, science in Christianity. So here's the outline of the class. I hopefully will get through the first half today. That'd be good. So I'm talking about the topic of science and religion, what science talks about, and then what religion talks about, where science and religion can maybe possibly cooperate in areas where we should let science do its thing and we should let religion, if in quotes, do its thing. Then I'll talk about the history of the relationship between science and Christianity going back to the Middle Ages. Then I'll talk very, very briefly about maybe the attitude, the approach, the tone we should take about where science and Christianity kind of overlap or inter-involve each other. Then we'll talk about the question of the age of the Earth and the age of the universe. You may not have a problem with that, but we need to discuss that in order to set up questions about the book of Genesis. And then I'll do a class on Genesis and creation. I should finish all that today. I may or may not have time to talk about the flood, and then I'm going to talk about evolution. Those are the three kind of biggie science issues or debates about creation, Genesis 1, about the flood, Genesis 8 through 7 through 9, and then evolution. And then I'll talk about the anthropic principle. I'll talk about evidence from science that supports the idea that God exists. Then I'll talk about a response to the philosophy of scientism or scientific materialism. And then I'll talk about science in the Bible and science in other religions. Okay? Great. Here's a list of suggested readings. Is there a God? Again, there's a link at the site you're at right now to go to IPI. You can pick up a copy of the book if you want. You can see I've highlighted some of the books that I think are particularly helpful for us to know how to interact with maybe non-Christians and even other Christians. I really like Francis Collins and Daryl Falk's book on evolution. I like Stephen Meyer's book on the creation of life. Some of these other books I don't agree with completely. But anyway, there's a few suggestions. So topic number one is science and religion. So we have to talk about what science is and what science does. We have to talk about religion broadly, what it is and what it does. I teach a section on science and religion in this Science 110 Intro to Scientific Thought class that I've taught for many years. Although I did retire, so I haven't taught it in a couple of years. But anyway, so science then is the use of experiment to test theories about the laws of nature. So this is science's territory. The subject of science is the laws of nature. The methodology of science is experimentation and formation of theories. Got it? All right. Scientific knowledge involves quantities. Scientific knowledge is progressive and tentative. In other words, scientific conclusions are never final. And scientific knowledge tends to improve over time. If you look back, your knowledge from science is always better than it was before, okay? If scientific knowledge stayed the same, that would be very concerning. By the way, everything on this slide is there on purpose because when we talk about what religion is and what religion does, essentially it's the opposite of what science is and science does. So hold on to that. Quantitative, progressive, tentative. Scientific knowledge does not involve true or false things. So science doesn't establish what is true. All right, and that's a common misunderstanding. What science does is establish explanations which are consistent with the evidence. So in science, we have two things: evidence, measurements, and then explanations, theories, hypotheses. And the idea is we want to come up with theories or hypotheses which are consistent with the evidence. Does the evidence prove the theory? No, it never does. A lot of atheists, a lot of sort of in-your-face materialists try to imply that science tells us what the answer, for example, of the origin of life is, but it simply doesn't do that. Okay, got it? Religion, broadly, including all religions, I guess, religion is a belief in something. It involves belief. Science doesn't have beliefs, at least theoretically. The belief is not necessarily substantiated by material evidence. All right, if religion has evidence, it's not usually of a material sort. All right, religious knowledge is obtained not through experiment, but through things like holy writings, authoritative religious figures, revelations such authoritative religious figures have, and from religious experience. Now, Christianity would lean very, very strongly towards holy writings as the source of knowledge. New Age, Hinduism, other religions might lean more towards religious experience or revelations from, religious leaders, things like that. And religionists, peoples who believe in religions, have faith or trust in this knowledge. In other words, faith or trust that it is, in fact, true. Okay? Religious knowledge is qualitative, not quantitative. So you can't measure the prayer level. My faith is on a level of 5.24. So science involves things you can quantify. Religion involves things you cannot quantify. In religion, knowledge is taken as either true or false. So we don't have alternative explanations. We say, according to our belief, this is true. Take it or leave it. And religious knowledge is not progressive. Now, the person who's part of the religion hopefully would progress over time. But the bottom line is, if a religion told you something and later said, no, that's not true, this is true instead, that would make you doubt the entire religion. I mean, I thought you were giving me the truth. So science ought to change, does change, and will change. And religion ought not to change, should not change, and hopefully does not change. Otherwise, why would you believe in it? Got it? So these are two very different animals. And our class today is on where a particular religion, Christianity, and this strange thing called science, where they kind of come into possibly conflict, possibly can work together. Okay, great. So in my philosophy of science class, I say science is really good at answering questions like when did that happen, what is that thing, where does it happen, how many are there, how long does it take, by what means. But science is not very good at answering questions like why. So science can answer a why as in, what is the mechanism by which that happens? But if you ask the philosophical question with a capital W, why, science doesn't answer that question at all. Now, here's a good question for the materialist, the determinist, who feels like science is kind of the ultimate answer for everything. Does anybody really care about when such and such happened, or what that thing is, or where is it? These questions are not the fundamental questions that human beings care about. And yet, I would argue that science is better at answering questions when, what, where, how many, by what means, I would argue, than any other methodology ever devised by human beings. Science is awesome at answering these questions. Okay, now here are some questions that science really stinks at answering. Why am I here? All right, if science provides an answer at all, it's a very, very unsatisfactory answer, like, as we'll see, a series of singularly beneficial accidents, as Thomas Huxley said. Is that the right thing to do? Science is useless in telling us whether that's a good thing to do or a bad thing to do, or a right thing to do or a wrong thing to do. Science can help with ethical questions on some level, but science is completely useless on moral questions. Another question, what is my purpose? Science would say, purpose? That word doesn't even mean anything. We could talk about, you know, why as in mechanistically why. So why do I have a finger so I can pick something up? But why do I exist? What's my value? Okay, science does not decide which is more valuable, gold or iron. If you're trying to build a skyscraper, gold is useless, iron's great. All right, if you're trying to make a conductor on an electrical circuit, iron's not so good, gold is great. All right, so what's my value? All right, science would say your value is about $3.52. There's some iron, some carbon, some manganese, some chromium. Value? Okay. Also, does God exist? Now, a lot of materialists would say you can answer the question of whether God exists, but I'm going to show that that is nonsense. That is just bogus philosophy. All right. Also, do miracles happen? Science, believe it or not, is not helpful virtually at all in answering the question whether miracles occur. Now, science is a little bit helpful there, because science could say, if that happened, now that would be a miracle. But science can't tell us whether it happened or not, because miracles are by their nature one-off events, and you can't do experiments about miracles, and you can't really have a scientific theory about the supernatural. So the supernatural is ruled out in terms of whether science can help to solve that problem. All right, got it? Now, I want to correct some misunderstanding about what science is good at saying or doing. All right, so you might have heard sort of an in-your-face atheist or agnostic saying, evolution is true. Now, scientists should not say that. I'm going to explain why. Or some people say, well, the Big Bang happened 13 point whatever billion years ago. Again, that's an opinion, I guess. But science does not establish that the Big Bang happened or whether evolution is true. So let me restate evolution is true and the Big Bang happened as the way a scientist, if they're speaking carefully, will say it. The theory of evolution is by far the best model we have to explain both the fossil evidence and the genetic evidence with regard to the origin of all species. Bottom line is, according to science, evolution is a very good theory for many reasons. Does that mean it's true? Well, what would it even mean to say that it's true? That arguably in science, that's a meaningless statement. Now, it may be true. It may be true that what we call the theory of evolution, that model, could explain the origin of all species. But whether it does or it does not, science is not in the position to decide that question. However, it is consistent. The theory of evolution is consistent with both fossil and genetic evidence. I'll talk about that later. I think that's going to be next Saturday. All right, now what about the Big Bang? Here's what I'd say about the Big Bang. The Big Bang is in dramatic agreement with all known facts about the origin and history of the universe. Now, when I teach my philosophy of science class, I call it science intro to scientific thought, I'll ask my students, according to science, did the Big Bang happen? And the students have been paying attention all semester, what they'll say is, don't know. But it's consistent. It's consistent with the data, and that's all we can do. Got it? So science seeks consistency, not truth. Religion offers potential truth. All right, science does not. What science does is ask this. What is the simplest? Occam's razor, we'll see that. And what is the most consistent explanation of the observation? Okay, now here's an interesting thing. Although science is not faith, does not use faith, and scientists arguably do not have faith, there are some underlying premises on which science itself is built. We're going to ask the question, where do these assumptions come from? But there are three basic assumptions when you take a philosophy of science class. These are assumptions that scientists make. Number one, science assumes that there exists a single unchanging set of laws which governs every event in the physical universe. Scientists assume this. So they assume that if I go over here, the laws will be the same as there. If I go to Alpha Centauri or the Andromeda Galaxy, the gravity constant will be the same. The second law of thermodynamics will work over there. And we also assume one set of laws for the entire universe and that those laws have never changed. Now, the next assumption is that human beings are able to understand how the universe works. If human beings could not understand how the universe works, then why would human beings even pursue knowledge about that universe? So we assume that. And we also assume, for reasons that I'll get to later, we also assume that the universe is governed by mathematical laws. In other words, we can apply the laws of mathematics to explain and describe the physical events in the universe. So these are the basic assumptions. I call the first one the fundamental presupposition, which is these laws exist, they're unchanging in time and place, also that humans can understand it and that it's mathematical. Okay, good. Now these assumptions are not scientific assumptions because we can't test them and we can't form theories to explain them. So they're accepted as true without proof. Not that they're shot in the dark, all right? There's pretty good reason to think that there is one set of laws and that it's the same throughout the universe because we can look in different places in the universe, all right? So these are not wild and crazy speculation. In fact, all three of these assumptions seem to be very consistent with what we know, all right? So they're accepted without proof. They form the foundation for all scientific thinking. In other words, they are assumptions that are accepted based on a kind of faith. So arguably it takes faith, maybe not religious faith, but it takes a kind of faith to be a scientist. Okay? All right, now, interesting, what are the origins? This is a good question. What are the origins of these assumptions? And this is going to get us to our next topic, which is the history of the relationship between science and Christianity. Where did these assumptions come from? Did the ancient peoples agree with these assumptions? Definitely not. All ancient peoples before the Greeks, and even the Greeks to some extent, believed that that nature was mysterious and that there were multiple sets of laws governed by various supernatural forces. And they certainly didn't propose that nature should be mathematical. So, let's take it back to, say, 13th century Europe, and we have somebody like Roger Bacon, a monk, a Dominican monk, and he's philosophizing, he's thinking about natural philosophy, and he decides, based on the nature of Christianity, that the universe will be governed by a single set of unchanging laws, right? Because the universe is governed by a single unchanging creator. Also, these early Christian theologians proposed the universe should be understandable by human beings, and that's where we get this idea of general revelation. In other words, it was obvious to Roger Bacon and others that God, the creator of the universe, who also created us, made us so that we could understand that universe. And also, we'll see these early Christian theologians propose that the universe should be mathematical. In other words, basically because God is a God of order and beauty, then therefore the universe should be ordered and beautiful. And that meant to them, obviously, it would be mathematical. Okay, got it? Now, where did this idea come from? This is Melvin Calvin. I like this quote. This is back in the 50s. Melvin Calvin was the first really important figure in trying to sort of prove, if you will, unsuccessfully, might I add, that life could have come about through a natural processes, the idea of abiogenesis. And he said, the fundamental conviction that the universe is ordered, which, by the way, is that first assumption of science, got it? The fundamental conviction the universe is ordered is the first and strongest tenet of scientists. He's agreeing with me, this is the fundamental presupposition. As I try to discern the origin of that conviction, I seem to find it in a basic notion discovered around 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, probably closer to 4,000, by the way, enunciated first in the Western world by the ancient Hebrews, namely that the universe is governed by a single God and is not the product of the whims of many gods, each governing its own province according to its own laws. This monotheistic view seems to be the historical foundation of modern science. You would think Melvin Calvin would then go on and say, aha, that's evidence that the Christian God is real. In fact, that's why we have science. It's not an accident that science was invented, if you will, by Christian theologians and monks, because science is the natural product of monotheism. I suppose a Muslim could have discovered science. It's possible. Wouldn't rule that out. But a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Zoroastrian? No, it doesn't make sense. So I'm going to conclude this section, start the next section. So here's my conclusion about the relationship between science and religion. Number one, religion and science ask very different kinds of questions about reality. Remember those two sets of questions? What's my purpose? What's my value? Is that the right thing to do? Where? When? How many? They ask different questions. They define words very differently. Even when they're talking about the same kinds of things, they use a different vocabulary. Religion and science appear as if they are two incommensurate paradigms. That, in other words, there's almost no overlap between both the kinds of data they look at and the kinds of questions they ask and seek to answer. All right? They appear to be incommensurate paradigms, which could therefore, in theory, coexist with relatively little interaction. In fact, Stephen Jay Gould, back, I believe, in the 80s, proposed that they are non-overlapping magisteria. In other words, this was a total skeptic, an atheist, trying to delve into something he didn't know a whole lot about, was religion, and basically saying, those religious people, that's their Tory, they can just do their thing, philosophy, you know, ultimate truth and stuff like that. That's not our territory. Now, I'm telling you, those who propose that science and religion are non-overlapping magisteria were not friendly towards religion. In fact, they use that as a way to say, yeah, whatever, you superstitious people. But I'm going to propose that they are not exactly non-overlapping magisteria. Here's why. I believe there are some basic questions that science will never let go of, and that religious people will also never let go of. There's three or four questions like that. One question is, what is a person? Do I have a body? Or am I a body? What is the nature of consciousness? I mean, when I say I want to go to the store, what does that mean? What's the meaning? What does it mean to be self-aware? What is a person? I believe neuroscience will not concede that question to religion. Every religion seeks to answer this question, and science also seeks to answer this question. So therefore, we will come in conflict in this area, naturally, and probably disagree. That's why I think for Christians to know a little bit about neuroscience is probably a good idea. Next is the origin of life. Every religion I've ever heard about claims to know how life began. And science seeks to supply an explanation for how life began. Now, either life began through a supernatural origin or through a natural origin. And those two, it can't be both. It cannot be both. So here's a question where there will continue to be some possible disagreement, even friction. Another one is on the origin of the universe. All religions have a cosmology. All religions that I know of propose essentially the history of the universe. And clearly science wants to say something about that. So those who say that these are non-overlapping magisteria, I think, are just plain wrong. Now, again, if we look back at these questions, I think Christians can live in a Christian world in which these questions are not important Christian questions in your practical everyday life. But I'm telling you, if you're going to be at universities, if you're going to interact with non-Christians, these are questions. Ignoring them is a really bad idea. Okay, got it? So part two of our outline is the history of the relationship between science and religion. Kind of hinted at that already a little bit. And, you know, we're in a bit of a spot where it seems like the loud scientists are calling religion, and specifically the Christian religion, stupid. And unfortunately, a significant number of conservative sort of religious right, but even mainstream evangelicals believe that science is misinforming us on very significant areas. So there is a battle, if you will, between science and religion. So how'd that happen? Has that always been the case? So let's look at that. So I already mentioned Roger Bacon, a monk, a Dominican monk. He was English, but he actually served in France in the 13th century. And some people would call him the first scientist. I would say, I don't know about that. He didn't do a whole lot of experiments, but he was perhaps the first really modern philosopher of science. He studied natural philosophy. He said to study natural philosophy, we call it science, we need to use external experience, aided by instruments, and made precise by mathematics. So you can see he's proposing that we can discover these universal natural laws through experience, through observation, through measurements, and through mathematics. So that's part two and part three of our assumption. In other words, he believed that nature could be understood by human beings, and that if it is understood, if laws can be discovered, those laws will exist, they'll be understandable, and they'll be mathematical. So you can see, like I said, the origin of science is Christianity. That is a fact. To deny that is to deny the truth of history. So, again, like I said, Roger Bacon deduced, if you will, from the nature of the God that he believed in based on the Bible and on his Catholic religion, that there's a single set of unchanging laws, the universe should be understandable, and it should be mathematical. William of Ockham, another empiricist from the 14th century, same thing, more of a philosopher. William of Ockham did more to actually turn Europe intellectually towards the place where we could start to actually do science. And he said this, he said, nothing is assumed as evidence unless it is known per se, is evidenced by experience, or is proved by authority of Scripture. So he argued there's three ways to gain knowledge. We can gain knowledge through deduction, in other words, things that are self-evidently true, like, you know, triangles have three sides, 1 + 1 = 2, and parallel lines don't intersect, whatever, these kinds of things. And then other truths can be acquired through induction, through observation and discovering of basic laws of the universe through observation. That would be what Roger Bacon was proposing. And then revelation. He argued that there'll be truth that'll be discoverable not by any logic, not by mathematics, not by experiment, but by revelation. Now, for William of Ockham, in order to discover Christian truth, probably he would say revelation is the go-to, and then observation and deduction, which would be kind of general revelation as opposed to special revelation. All right, he would argue in Christianity, revelation would probably get the first stab at it. But he would argue, and he did, that in studying natural philosophy, probably induction would be the place to start. And then there's the famous Occam's razor, in which Occam proposed that which can be explained by fewer assumptions is explained in vain by more. So this set the idea in science that if we have alternative explanations, the most elegant one, the simplest one, with the least assumptions, is to be preferred. So really, science seeks consistent and simple explanation. Consistent with the evidence, Roger Bacon, and the simplest, most elegant explanation, William of Ockham. This Occam's razor, which is really just a principle, it's just a way of thinking and answering questions, this was used essentially to remove God from science, as we'll see further on down the road here, a couple more slides. Okay, we have Nicolai Copernicus, arguably the first person really actually doing science. He was the one who discovered that apparently the planets move around the sun and not everything revolves around the Earth. So for Copernicus, we have Ptolemy, the Earth is the center of the universe, everything's going around the Earth. Copernicus says, no, actually the Earth is a little planet, the other planets, there's a much bigger sun here. All right, so the heliocentric model. He wasn't a priest or a monk, he was a canon of the church. He said, true assumptions must save the appearances. In other words, as we look at nature, our proposals, our theories, our hypotheses need to be consistent with the data that we're observing. So here we see somebody whose interest in science was primarily theological. In other words, he saw natural philosophy or science as a means to understand God. Again, we're going to have these two sources of knowledge that early scientists seem to agree. There's going to be general revelation and special revelation. Special revelation is knowledge that comes by revelation from God, the Bible, if you will. And then general revelation is things that seem to be true about God that anybody can discover through studying the natural world. And so these natural philosophers were trying to shed light on that. The purpose of all the early scientists was to explain and understand God. I am not exaggerating or covering up. That's the truth. Okay? Galileo, the first one to establish science as a thing done in a laboratory through controlled experiments. Galileo famously said, the Bible is written to tell us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. Now, we talked about what science is good at and what religion is good at. Basically saying, how the heavens go, science is the go-to on that one. How we go to heaven, science is not going to help us out there. He's in agreement with William of Ockham that that's really a religious question. So he's proposing that the Catholic religion should leave science alone. And he's proposing that science is the friend of religion. We'll see a quote on that in the next slide. In discussions of physical problems, we ought to begin not from the authority of scriptural passages, but from sense experiences and necessary demonstrations. In other words, in questions about the age of the earth, or the origin of the universe, or the origin of life or species, he argues these are physical questions, so we should let science have the first go at these questions. And therefore, he proposed the Roman Curia should leave him alone to do his experiments. All right, now here is his statement about general and special revelation. For the Holy Bible and the phenomena of nature proceed alike from the divine word. The former is the dictate of the Holy Spirit, and the latter as the observant executor of God's commands. So basically, God is revealing himself to us through his special revelation. He's a Christian. His two daughters were nuns, and he was an Orthodox Christian. All right, and so one source of truth is the Holy Bible, and another source of truth is the physical universe, and those two are speaking from the same Creator God. So general revelation would be natural revelation, and then special revelation would be the Bible. Okay. Now, so up until this is the 17th century, right? The 17th century. Up to the 17th century, the idea that science and religion could even conceivably have any cross purposes seemed insane. In fact, science was essentially a branch of theology up to this time. But then we have Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton, interesting guy. He was probably a deist. It's hard to really buttonhole Newton. He wrote many Bible commentaries. He certainly claimed to be a Christian. But let's just talk about Newton. Newton famously said, "Whence is it we see all the order and beauty in the universe?" And he argued for essentially the anthropic principle, which we'll talk about, the argument for design. He argued from the natural laws that he was involved in discovering, this is clear evidence for a creator. But his creator was maybe not our creator. He was a deist. He proposed what we call the mechanical universe, that the physical universe operates according to purely physical laws. And he proposed that God is the prime mover, but that he is either not involved at all or has a very, very limited role in determining what happens in this world. He was skeptical of miracles. He was skeptical of the resurrection. In fact, in order for him to be a member of the House of the Lords, they had to have the kind of the British equivalent of a constitutional amendment, because he definitely would not have raised his hand and said, you know, whatever. So with Isaac Newton, and by the way, this goes back to Occam's razor. Basically, Occam's razor says, it seems like every single thing that we observe does not need a supernatural explanation. In fact, he argued that the planets move according to the laws of gravity. Kepler had said that the angels are moving the planets. So the idea of imposing supernatural explanations in the natural realm was cut out. And I believe this was not an attempt to oppose Christianity. In fact, it was a natural next step in the evolution of what we call science. Now we can look back at Newton and say, wow, that was the beginning of something that kind of went pretty crazy for us, not so good. Okay, but so basically religion is kicked out. Now, at this point, I would say, literally all scientists in the early 18th century were believers, even Newton. All right, but as we come into the 19th century, this starts to change in the period known as the Enlightenment. So we have Voltaire and other skeptics. Voltaire was an enemy for sure of the Catholic religion, but arguably of all religion in general. Basically, religion is the opiate of the people, more or less. And then we have David Hume, who was a skeptic, maybe an atheist altogether. He said extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. He would argue the resurrection is a pretty extraordinary claim. He would argue there is no proof, which I totally disagree with. And so science is beginning to produce active members who are beginning to question whether we even need to invoke God at all. So by the time we get into the 19th century, science, which came from Christianity, which was a branch of Christian theology, is beginning to produce a crop of people who are using their science to question the need and possibly even the validity for religion altogether. Famously, Joseph Priestley, friend of Benjamin Franklin, was a deist. He, you know, it's debatable whether he gets full credit. He helped to found what we call the Unitarian Universalist Church. He was a deist, as was Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson. Our founding fathers in America, I know many of you are not Americans, but were deists, not Christians. Okay, Laplace famously said in the early 19th century, friend of Napoleon, he presented a book on his explanation of Newton's laws, and Napoleon asked him, well, where's God in all this? Where's God in your world that you're describing here? Laplace famously said, I have no need of that hypothesis. So the idea that science and Christianity could be going in dramatically opposing directions began to emerge in the 19th century. And then science started trying to answer questions that Christians thought, I believe unwisely, and Galileo would agree with me, thought was answered by the Bible. And so we have James Hutton in 1780s and 90s proposing that the earth is very, very old, and he came up with the idea of uniformitarianism. Charles Lyell in the 19th century, the leading supporter of this idea of uniformitarianism, which is that the physical earth has developed by processes observable today, but acting over vast periods of time. Okay, how old is the earth? James Hutton, in 1795 edition of his book, said, no vestige of a beginning, no concept of an end. No vestige of a beginning, in other words, who knows? Really old. How old? Don't know. And then he said, why he said this? No concept of an end. And so, he said, we could just sort of extrapolate into the future, and what's been happening for a very long time will continue to happen for a very long time. This could make Christians perhaps nervous. All right, but anyway. And then there's Charles Darwin, famously, 1859, A Theory of Evolution. Atheists and agnostics have tried to claim Darwin, but that's probably not true. Darwin, like Hutton and many scientists in the 18th and 19th century, was a deist. He didn't believe in supernatural, but he believed in a universe of order, which is evidence of a God, a creator God. And Darwin himself said, it's mere rubbish at this point to think of the origin of life. One might as well think of the origin of matter itself. So as to his was a theory of the origin, not of life, but the origin of species. Remember those questions that science and religion will never let go of? I believe religion will not let go of the question of the origin of life, but I'm not sure why religion speaks to the origin of species. These are two very different questions. Charles Darwin did not have an origin of life theory. In fact, he if you read his book, Origin of Species, he seems to be firmly of the opinion that life was created by God. You might be surprised. All right, Albert Einstein, another famous deist, didn't believe in Christianity. He was Jewish by culture, but not Jewish by practice. He said, science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind. He saw a place for religion in culture and society. Okay, but then something happened. When The Theory of Evolution was published in 1859, you might be surprised to know that in Europe, almost all Christians sort of went along with that. They had virtually no, but you don't see books being written by Christians saying evolution is bogus. Good luck finding one of those. In fact, the problem with the Scopes monkey trial was not over the origin of life. It was over the idea of eugenics. And the idea that we could improve humans through selective breeding and stuff, there's a really bad history there, to say the least. So at this point in the 20th century, the first half of the 20th century, certain Christians began to be extremely defensive against scientific answers to things like the age of the earth, the origin of life, and the origin of species. So this classic idea that we grew up with, which is that conservative Christianity is very defensive and oppositional towards the scientific community, and also the origin of scientific community having an attitude and like, you guys, you're wrong, leave us alone. This happened in the 20th century. And so we have the Creation Research Society, and we have the Genesis Flood. And this is when, not so much in Europe, but certainly in America, but also in Africa, in Russia, and significant, wherever evangelical Christianity kind of rules out over, let's say, older religions like a Catholic and Orthodox, the idea that the earth is young, that science agrees with this, and that science, that sort of science is in Satan or hand in glove and all that kind of stuff, this is a fairly new phenomenon. And I want to help us push that aside, okay? This is making Christianity look downright stupid, okay? Now, if I just got you mad at me, I apologize, but I need to explain myself, okay? Now, this sort of young earth creationist movement, scientists generally are, by the way, there are a lot of scientists who are Christians. In my chemistry department at Grossmont College, we had 8 full-time faculty members. 4 of them were professing Christians. 1 was a professing Jew, and 3 of them were maybe agnostic, or, I believe 2 of them were skeptical of Christianity altogether and of God. And so, but this is kind of normal. So, Christians who are scientists began to concede that the earth is old, but remain skeptical of evolution. So I'll talk about this, a debate we did a few years, 4 Christian views of evolution. So the scientists began to carve out this middle ground in the 1980s and 90s in this thing called intelligent design and the idea of irreducible complexity. And they began to argue that evolution is a bad theory, but the Bible and science are consistent with the earth being quite old. In other words, God created all these different species, and that evolution, the theory of evolution, is still kind of, the enemy of Christianity, all right? And so that God created life, God created all the species, and therefore Genesis 1 is a perfectly accurate view of reality, and science is kind of all wet, at least in the era of evolution, because evolution is not proved, not that it doesn't happen, but, we have microevolution and macroevolution. These irreducible complexity people would kind of rule out macroevolution, but they would totally concede on microevolution and on the earth being very old. All right. Now, there's a couple problems with this, because this was used to try to push evolution out of our school systems. So the young earth creationists and the intelligent design people were kind of together sort of saying evolution is not true, we should remove it from curricula. And the problem with intelligent design, this is a subtle question. I believe intelligent design is not scientific. Now, I believe in intelligent design. Obviously, I believe that there is an intelligent designer. Are you kidding? But I don't believe that intelligent design is a scientific theory, because we cannot do experiments to test for design, and we cannot disprove design. And any proposal that cannot be either proved by experiment or disproved by experiment is essentially not a scientific idea. Now, I believe intelligent design can be mentioned in my philosophy of science class. Belongs there. But were you going to do design experiments in a biology class and a chemistry class? And besides, this tends to go towards God of the Gap arguments. So Behe and Ross and some of these intelligent design people who were so popular in the 80s and 90s, as we get into the 21st century, they're having to kind of, oh, well, you know, maybe not. Okay, yeah. Okay, well. Because basically these God of the Gap arguments, for example, how did the eye form? Or how do you explain how we went from, say, I don't know, from amphibians to mammals? These things cannot be explained by any rational series of events, natural events. Well, the problem with these gap theories is they tend to get filled in. And over time, intelligent design has become in some ways untenable, at least in its interaction with the question of evolution. All right, so I believe in intelligent design. I'll talk about intelligent design in my class today and next Saturday, absolutely. But I do believe the intelligent design community is not necessarily doing Christianity a favor. I appreciate the sincerity of these people, but I believe that that probably we should leave science questions to scientists. All right? So that's what I propose. I think the intelligent design movement, it's probably caused as many problems as it's solved. I read Behe, I read Ross, I read Meyer. These guys are good people, and I think they have some helpful things to say. In fact, I like Meyer's book, Signature in the Cell. Anyway, I'll talk about the anthropic principle later on. I'm going to move on. So part three is, so fine, given sort of what science does, what religion does, and the history, the awesome history of science and religion in the past, but the kind of problematic history most recently, what should the scientist's response to all this be? Well, let me propose a few things. Number one, we need to remember what Galileo said with regard to the Roman Curia. We should probably, as believers, let scientists answer questions about the physical world. When we try to impose things like, you know, the Bible says the sun set, therefore the earth doesn't move, and all this sort of stuff. If you go back to Galileo, where the religionists were saying the earth is the center of the universe, science was saying differently. Science was right. The Christians were wrong. But that's because they were trying to have the Bible answer a question it wasn't intended to answer. So on questions about origin of species, age of universe, whether the earth moves, blah, 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 I think we should probably keep a hands-off approach. Science and religion are, in general, incommensurate, and let's let religion do what it does. Let science do what it does. Call out those atheists and naturalists when they attempt to answer religious questions with science. They're always bogus. Call them out on that. But if you can do that, be consistent and let science handle questions about nature. Good? I believe, now here I'm just making, this is just rhetoric. This is just a statement of my part, which I will support throughout the rest of the time today and mainly next week. I believe science and the Bible do not contradict on any significant point at all. I believe science is absolutely the friend of Christianity and should be used as a friend of Christianity, and that scientists, so that Christians should stop trying to disprove science. Bad idea. So science is your friend. Now, the enemy is not science. The enemy is deterministic, materialistic, atheist philosophy. Absolutely, that is your enemy, but not science. So we need to keep that dichotomy in our mind. And I say, as the Christian, be confident. I'm telling you, in the final analysis, the evidence says the universe was created from nothing, and that life itself is supernatural origin. And the thing that makes us human is clear evidence of, essentially, we were created in the image of God. Okay? Here's Francis Collins. Oh, that's an old picture. Francis Collins has been on the news all the time lately. That's a really old picture. He wrote the book, The Language of God. That's one of the ones I recommend. The head of the NIH, he headed the Genome Project. He along with Fauci, have been on TV more than just about anybody else. He's a Christian. He's a mere Christianity convert. Here are some reasons that the head of the NIH and the former head of the Genome Project, perhaps the most influential scientist in America, even the world today, he believes the reasons to believe in God is there is something as opposed to nothing, and the mere existence of something is evidence of a creator. He says the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics, going back again to those assumptions of science, the Big Bang, which seems to prove without a reasonable doubt that everything came from nothing. Nature doesn't solve the question of why. Remember that? I talked about that earlier. The existence of time, the fine-tuning of the universe, which I'll talk about later. Occam's razor. Basically, what he's saying is the simplest way to explain everything I know is to allow for the existence of God, that trying to kick God out of the explanation of the universe makes things more complicated, not less. And he also believes in the moral argument, which is not part of our class. Okay, great. Now, next, number four in our outline. I think we're going to get through five. Yep, I'm looking good. I'm going to go about another 20, 25 minutes. I want to talk about the age of the universe. By the way, the stuff you probably came to this class for is next Saturday, okay? You know, why science and the Bible are consistent, how we can use the Bible to support science and science to support the Bible, how science kind of supports Christianity. That's next Saturday, okay? I'm laying the groundwork. Sorry. I feel like this is the right order to do. Okay, let's talk about the age of the universe. Now, Galileo said, the Bible tells us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. And the age of the universe or the earth or anything else. He would argue that this is a question involving the physical world, which should be settled by science. But, you know, famously, Bishop Usher, the Irish bishop in 1640, proposed that the earth was created on October 23rd, 4004 BC, trying to use the genealogies and all that in Genesis to get the exact age of the earth. Okay, now, if you were to ask Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, these early scientists, how the universe is, they probably would have answered it's several thousand years old. If you ask them why they thought that, they would have said, that's not my science. That's kind of my religious end. But the bottom line is, at this point, science hadn't begun to speak to the question of the age of the Earth. It wasn't until the end of the 18th century that scientists began to use actual data and physical evidence to try to answer that question. And this produced a paradigm shift towards what we call uniformitarianism. All right, so that's how we're starting. But the science helps to answer the question of the age of the universe and the age of the Earth. Now, here's an easy question. Which one's been around longer, the universe or the Earth? Well, you could say they're created at about the same time, like 2 days later or something like that. Or you could say, well, one thing for sure is universe first, then Earth, correct? Let's talk about the age of the universe. All right. So we use what's called the redshift. All right, let's say you've got a race car coming by. It goes like this. When something's going away from you, the wave it emits have a lower frequency when you hear it. Now, we talk about the redshift, the blue, red. All right, and it turns out it was discovered in the 1920s. That all very distant objects have this thing called a red shift. Okay? If you look at the light coming from different stars, the light coming from the sun has these, you can see these absorbance lines there due to the elements in the atmosphere of the sun. And it turns out, if you look at the absorbance lines in The sun, it says star, that should say sun. It's in one place. If you look at a galaxy that's, say, 100 million light years away, those same lines are shifted slightly to the right, which is towards the red, towards lower frequency. But if you look at a distant galaxy, let's say 500 million light years away, it's shifted even more towards the red. But if you look at a quasar, which is, let's say, 10 billion light years away, then you see that it's shifted even farther. And it's very consistent. Hubble talked about this. All right, the faster the recession, the greater the red shift. If you look at different galaxies, and there are a lot of them, the Hubble telescope showed us this. Now this graph, if you don't get this graph, it's okay. The vertical axis is the recession speed based on the size of the red shift, and the horizontal axis is distance. And so there's the Hubble constant. Don't worry about that. The bottom line is what this shows is that the universe is expanding. And the farther away something is, the faster it's expanding, which makes sense because if the universe is expanding, the things that are closer to you are moving similar speed to you, so they're moving away from you fairly slowly. But the things that are farther away from you, they're obviously, the reason they're farther away from you is because they've been moving away from you faster. Obvious to us anyway. So this red shift gives us the ability to measure the distance to objects. Because if you go back, if you know the speed of fairly nearby objects and their distance, you can get this graph. And then if you have objects whose distance you cannot measure, you can begin to measure their distance by the recession speed. So begin to get a sense for the size of the universe. So if we wind back the redshift, two things. Number one, it allows us to estimate the age of the universe. And number two, it tells us the universe had a beginning. Right now, the first question, the second question will come up later. So basically then, if we can find the farthest object in the universe, we can therefore estimate the age of the universe. Got it? And then there's the microwave background radiation, which is the leftover energy from this initial creation event, which was discovered in the early 1960s by accident, which basically a very, very, very low frequency light that was the original light emitted when the universe became transparent. A test of the Big Bang Theory, we can see the expansion of the universe. We can see this cosmic microwave background radiation, which was predicted from the Big Bang Theory back in the 1930s, but was not observed until the 1960s. And when that cosmic microwave background radiation, this very low frequency light that exudes the entire universe, when that was discovered, that was considered essentially like the smoking gun of this creation event. So by the early to mid 60s, the Big Bang model was virtually the only remaining model. There's more to it than that, but it's close enough. Also, in the 30s and 40s, Big Bang model people predicted, based on the nature of this creation event, that the universe should be made of almost all hydrogen, a little bit of helium, and tiny, tiny amounts of all their elements. And it turns out when we look at material in the interstellar media, the prevalence of different elements in interstellar media seems to exactly model what the Big Bang says. So we have three pieces of information: expanding universe, cosmic microwave background radiation, and relative abundance of elements. All of this says Big Bang model, remember what I said, is consistent with all the evidence we have for the origin and history of the universe. So this allows us to estimate the age of the universe. If we extrapolate the current expansion rate back using the Hubble constant and the most distant object, we get the universe to be around 13.5 billion years. Now, it turns out there's another separate method because we know sort of the evolution of stars, and we can use things that I'm not going to talk about here. We can estimate the age of the stars, and it turns out the oldest existing interstellar object, this says 13.0 billion. I think the Hubble numbers have changed that to probably closer to 13.3, 13.4 billion. So the bottom line is we have two separate methods without overlap to measure the age of the universe. One is from the size of the redshift and from the apparent age of certain very, very old galaxies. They seem to agree. Therefore, my conclusion is the science says that what's consistent with the data is our universe is around 13.5 billion years old. Got it? You may not like that. Now, could God make the universe to appear that old? Yes, I'll talk about that. I will talk about appearance of age. Does this prove the universe is that old? No, it doesn't. Science doesn't do that. All right, there you go. 13.4 plus or minus. I need to change that slide. 13.4 plus or minus 0.2. All right, so we talked about that. And there's clear evidence. What about the Earth? What about the age of the Earth? Never mind the universe. What about the age of the Earth? James Hutton began to introduce the concept of deep time. How much time? Hutton honestly said, I have no idea. A long time. Many millions for sure. Many, many millions minimum. Billions, trillions, don't know. All right, we go to the Grand Canyon and we say, those who say the Earth is 5, 6,000 years old, they're all wet. They're just not dealing with reality. That just doesn't work very well. William Smith began to look not at geology, which is what Hutton did. Hutton looked at geology. He's the father of modern geology. All right, William Smith began to look at paleontology, same time frame, late 1700s, early 1800s. And he discovered the idea of index fossils. Each stratum has fossils peculiar to itself. In other words, as we look in the fossil record, things down here are not found up here. And the order is consistent. So therefore, he concluded, these things are older. These things are younger. All right, the numbers that you've got on the screen for Cenozoic, Mesozoic, and Paleozoic, these are not from William Smith. These are things from data we'll talk about in a bit. All right, so we have the Paleozoic, Precambrian, all that sort of stuff. The idea of the Mesozoic, the Jurassic, the Cambrian, the Devonian, the Ordovician, all this sort of stuff. This goes back to index fossils, early 1800s. And William Smith made a geologic map of Great Britain and giving the relative ages of the different rock formations at the surface. He was a civil engineer. All right, so there you go. You get the idea of index fossils. Nowhere in the Earth do you find the entire fossil record. So you don't find rocks that are 10, 50, 100, 150, 200, 300. They're nowhere. That's not how the history of the Earth works. But you have this consistency. Trilobites are always below dinosaurs. Dinosaurs are always below humans. Do not listen to the young Earth creationists. They're full of baloney. Humans and dinosaurs definitely did not live at the same time. That's, ridiculous. Don't believe it. They may have museums that show these nice dioramas. It's a bunch of baloney. Okay, now, how old is the Earth? Well, less than 13.5 billion, right? Makes sense, okay. The physical laws, gravity, and the entropy, all that can kind of explain the origin. We have theories for the origin of solar systems and planets and all that. Great. So what about the Earth? Well, Hutton had no idea. There was Lord Kelvin proposed the Earth was something like 30 million years old based on some other stuff I won't talk about. But in the early 20th century, Rutherford and others invented the idea of radioisotope dating. So we have uranium 238 with a half-life of 4.5 billion years. Uranium decays to lead. So a young rock would have all uranium 238 and no lead 206. It would have other isotopes of lead, but not lead 206. Got it? And so let's say you have a rock that's 99% uranium-238 and only 1% lead-206. That rock would be, let's say, 25 million years old. If you have a rock that's like, say, 70% uranium-238 and 30% lead-206, that's a really old rock. It might be 800 million years old. Don't worry about the math of this. Pretty simple stuff. And by the way, it's not just uranium-lead. It's also thorium-lead, potassium-argon. There are other dating methods, and we can cross-reference this. Some rocks have no uranium. So then we can look at the amount of potassium and argon. That's problematic. These methods are not perfect. They give discrepant data at times. And I think atheists and scientists have occasionally created the wrong impression that this is like, you know, perfect and not without problems. Bottom line is, the oldest rock discovered on the Earth so far is around 4.35 billion years. So why do they say 4.5 billion years? Because meteors and rocks that were found from the moon date closer to 4.5 billion years. So it seems that our solar system formed around 4.5 billion years ago. There are other, just like I said with the age of the universe, at least two different methods of giving the same number. We can talk about the moon is moving away from the Earth. We can use models to discover when the Earth moon was captured by the Earth. Estimates are between 3 and 5 billion years. Bottom line is, the scientific evidence points to around 4.5 billion years. Does that mean the Earth is that old? No. Could God create the Earth appearing old? Sure could. That's where we go. All right, now how much time do I have? I've got about another 5 or 10 minutes. Okay. Well, I'm finally getting into the material you probably came for. Want to start talking about Genesis 1? All right. So we're going to talk about creation. We're going to talk about flood. And we're going to talk about evolution. Those are the three scientific hot issues, if you will. Then we'll talk about God and science. And that'll pretty much finish us out. I'm going to talk about creation just a little bit. All right, so what is the origin, not of the universe, but of the Earth, and what is the history of the Earth? Well, there's the young Earth theory, as you know, which is, you know, Bishop Usher would be solid on that. Now, there's two schools here. One is the school, the young Earth creationists. This is Wickham and Morris and all these sort of people who I don't appreciate, honestly, appreciate their heart, their sincerity, but not what they're doing. What they're saying is the Earth is only a few thousand years old, and they're saying science supports that conclusion. I'm telling you, that is simply not true. There is no evidence ever discovered anywhere which points to the Earth being only a few thousand years old. I'm just telling you the facts, whether you like it or not. You can be angry at me if you want, and you can read all your young Earth creationist articles. They're a bunch of pseudoscience, just a whole pack of pseudoscience. Okay? Now, the other concept is the Earth is young, but that's because this great, powerful, you know, John the Baptist said that God could create children of Abraham out of these stones. I believe it. Jesus made fish, and it was good to go. Ready, you know, it appeared to be, I don't know, a couple few years old. I mean, God parted the Red Sea. I believe it. God could have created the universe and the Earth so that there's dinosaur fossils in the ground, there's trilobite fossils in the ground, and all this sort of stuff, okay? God could have created the Grand Canyon with all those millions of layers of rock and make it appear that they'd been laid down over vast ranges of time. God could do that if he wanted to. In fact, arguably, in some sense, he's already done that. The fish that Jesus made was ready to go, good to eat. And if you accept the idea of creation ex nihilo for Adam and Eve, no belly button. Okay, got it? Here's the problem. The young Earth creationists refuse to say that. Why? Because they're trying to argue against science, all right? And if you say that God created the universe and the Earth with the appearance of age, what you're saying is that's not a scientific statement. You're making a statement about religion. And science literally cannot disprove this idea. Science cannot disprove that the Earth is young. Now, I'm not saying I accept this idea. What I'm saying is the young Earth theory in agreement with science is nonsense. Please stop saying that. The young Earth theory, because God created that way just because he wanted to, and don't, you know, talk to God about that. I believe that's philosophically defendable, but I can't find anybody to defend that idea. Why? Because their purpose in creating this idea would be to talk to scientists, and basically you're saying scientists, that's irrelevant. Then there's the day-age theory. That's the one I'm going to defend. Then there's the framework theory, which some of my scientists, Christian friends, work with, and I have no problem with the framework model. I'll talk about those. I only have, 5 minutes to go here. The framework model says basically day 1, 2, and 3 and day 4, 5, and 6. Day 1 and 4, God creates the heavens. Day 2 and 5, God creates the sea and the land. Day 3 and 6, God creates life. Basically, the framework model says this is a theological statement. It's a statement about God. It's a claim that God is the creator, and there's no historical information in Genesis 1 at all. Basically, it's a list of what God did, arranged topically, not chronologically, and there is no actual scientific information contained in that at all. That's a great idea. Doug Jacoby, many of you know Doug Jacoby. He's a solid framework theory guy. That's fine. Awesome. I'm a day-age guy who's admits that the framework model has its possibilities. The gap theory, I don't have time for that, running out of time. Basically, God created the universe a long time ago, then nothing, 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 and then suddenly about 6,000 years ago, he sort of zoop, kind of created the things you can observe, solves no problems, doesn't make sense. The other idea is Genesis 1 is a bunch of, it's just like all the other creation myths. They're all just a bunch of myths. There is no information. It tells us absolutely nothing. Okay, day-age theory. A quick summary of Genesis 1. God preexisted the universe. Hebrews 1, 2, and also Genesis 1, 1. God created the universe. This creation event is described by God saying, let there be light, which is consistent with the Big Bang model. Then later, God created the earth. Although framework model people would say, nah, that's not really what it says, but that's what I would say. And then God created life, and then God created last of all, and the peak of his creation is human beings. If this is consistent with Genesis 1, then that means Genesis 1 is consistent so far anyway with science. This is the day-age model. Day 1, God creates the universe. It's spinning. We have night and day. Day 2, there's a very thick atmosphere. Water's covering the earth. Day 3, land emerges. Day 4, life. Day 3, life emerges. Day 4, because of life, essentially life eating methane and ammonia and chemically evolving the atmosphere. On day 4, the heavens become visible to the human eye. And so we have the sun, moon, the star. Day 4, not day 1. Day 1, we have day and night. Day 3, we have life. Day 4, the starry objects finally emerge. Day 5, or life comes up on land. Day 6, even more complex forms of life. And last of all, human beings. This is the day-age model. The day-age model assumes that these days are metaphorical in their, the 24-hour thing, but that there is, that proposes that essentially there is some historical usable information, even though that's not what the Genesis writer was trying to do. The Genesis writer was telling us information about God, not about nature. Nevertheless, to the extent that it gives us information about nature, it's at least consistent with what we know about nature. That's the day-age theory. I'm not going to argue against the framework model. All right. Is Genesis a myth? I have to stop there. Here we go. You can see what we're going to do. We're going to talk about the flood. Then we're going to talk about evolution. Then we're going to talk about God and science, how science seems to prove a creator, and then science appears to prove God, etc. Okay, great. Now I'm going to stop sharing. All right. I'm going to come back, and I'm going to take questions from the chat. I wish, I really do wish, that we could, let's see here. Yeah, I wish we could take questions by audio. I really feel bad about that. Maybe I can open up a Zoom call afterward or something like that. That'd be kind of fun. All right. In fact, I'm going to do that. I'm going to type in a Zoom address. All right, so I just typed in a Zoom address. So we'll do some Q&A for whatever, 10, 15 minutes, something like that. And then we'll go to a Zoom discussion where we can actually talk in a few minutes, okay? So I'm going to go through these questions in the chat and see if there's ones that I can answer. Okay, thank you for your comments, Dalibor. Okay, could Genesis 1 be an overview containing facts about the creation? Whereas Genesis 2 fills out the details. Simon Phillips, thank you. The answer is there are two creation accounts. All right, I don't know if you ever noticed that. And almost certainly, by the way, the two creation accounts were written by different people. I hope I'm not bursting a bubble. Moses did not write Genesis. He may have possibly been involved in editing it, but didn't write it. That makes sense. And it seems that there are two creation accounts. The first one covers the entire creation, and then the second account, which starts in Genesis 2, verse 1, or maybe just 2, verse 4, that's an account of the creation of human beings, and everything that happens in the second creation account would have occurred in the sixth day. All right, and if you look at everything that happens in this second creation account, it seems like it would take more than 24 hours, by the way. So yes, if we allow for there to be some historical information, which I personally believe there is, then yes, the second creation account would be a telescope of that sixth day. God creates humans in his image, and then the humans begin to name the different species. The woman is created and all that sort of stuff. So I would say yes. Paul's leaving. He's saying that we'll be sent a copy in 24 hours for the next link, I think. Good. Thank you, blah, blah, blah. Great link. We'll not be here next Saturday. Sorry, Andreas. Okay. Here's another question. As science offers the best plausible explanation based on coherent evidence, science doesn't say something is true. Science upgrades. We can't be sure science gave definite answer to fight with COVID. Okay, now, like I said, science is excellent at answering questions about where, when, and why being by what means. And I believe science is the only place we should be going for questions about how to deal with the COVID crisis. And I am so thankful that science has produced our ability to create vaccinations, that we understand the nature of messenger RNA and ribosomal RNA and all these different kinds of things, DNA. And I would say absolutely, without question, trust science on coronavirus. And those who say not to, I believe, forgive me, but I say you should stop saying that. It's dangerous. Okay? I strongly believe that the vaccinations are the only way we can really get through this. Thank God for the vaccination. And when Christians start denying science, they make Christianity look foolish. Please stop doing that. Please stop creating the false impression that science is the enemy of anything. Listen to the scientists. All right? And we can and we will, we human beings, with God's help, we can and we will solve the problem of the coronavirus only through science. And those who try to oppose science, such as certain political leaders in America, they're going to have to answer to God for that. How do you discuss science with Christians who, as a result of believing science is the enemy, distrust any scientific conclusion? I'd say send them to this class. Give them a copy of The Language of Science, or the copy of, that's Francis Collins' books, or my book, Is There a God? Or maybe they can join BioLogos, or a Coming to Peace with Science. Just give them a book by a mainstream scientist who's a Christian, and, you know, and it's these young earth creationists who created the problem, I believe. Now, are there aggressive atheist scientists who are sort of amplifying the problem? Absolutely. All right, absolutely. So I believe that classes like this, in which we engage in scientific information undefensively, and yet we're still left with the Bible being inspired by God, God being creator, God being savior. You know, every single point of Christian doctrine and theology is consistent with everything we know about science. God invented evolution. Give him credit for it. So I'd say we just have to have good discussions, informed discussions. I think there are books you can use. I've mentioned three of them. There's others in my list. Hello, Simon from Edinburgh. Oh, yeah, I know Simon real well. Simon was in Canada for a while. Ah, Dalibor. I believe I've met you, Dalibor. I've been in Zagreb, that's for sure. I was there probably 8 years ago. All right, I'm looking for other questions. Other questions. Let me see. Going up this way. Are there any... anybody with questions, please put them in now. I'm not seeing other questions. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to end this session. Got it? And I'm going to open up a Zoom meeting so we can have, you know, discussion, right? So there's 24 of us left. I'm guessing only 10 or 15 will go to the Zoom session, but I'm going to do that. I'm going to go to that Zoom session right now. All right, so I'll still be talking. You'll still hear me on this thing. But once I get there, I'll shut down this meeting, okay? So there we go. I'm going to open up that Zoom meeting right now. You can still hear me. Okay. But the meeting will exist in the next 30 seconds. It'll be fun to see who shows up. This will be fun. Okay. All right. Okay, I'm launching the Zoom meeting now. Andreas is there already. Now, what I'm going to do, guys, women, ladies, people, I'm going to go back to the webinar and I'm going to close it down, okay? So if you want to come and have our discussion here, you need to write down that address. All right. Roland, you're welcome. Bye, Marlene. Okay. Oh, Simon, you weren't in Canada? I thought you were. I'm sorry. All right, so here we go. Goodbye, Webinar Jam. There's the password. 3, 2, 1. Gone. All right. Hey, John, how's it going? Didn't know you were at the class. Carla, have I met you, Carla?
No. I wrote you a couple of times.
What's your last name?
Paul.
Okay, good. Anyway, hey folks. Everybody turn on your, oh, sorry about that. Can't start video.
Oh. Probably because you're in the other one still.
Oh, but I thought I turned it off. All right.
Maybe the
just imagine I'm here. Let's just talk. I don't feel like messing with it.
The whole time, so now you can see us.
Oh, I've got another idea. I've got another camera. Did that work?
Nope.
Oh, whatever. Hey, what's up? Any thoughts, any questions, comments?
No, I thought your class was excellent. For me, it's pretty intimidating just learning. It's not like I haven't heard of this information. It's just that for me, processing information can be a challenge, and it's just a lot. But I definitely wanted to become more mature in understanding the evidences, not that science is the enemy or anything like that, but just understanding it. Because when I do get questions, if God exists, how about this and that? And I'm like, okay, it's not like you can just jump to like say something like, oh, you just need to have faith or whatever.
Yeah.
So I think for me, I'm challenging myself to go deeper and to be more well-rounded.
Good.
As a person.
Do you have much background in science itself? Okay.
Not at all.
Yeah.
So everything was like, okay.
Yeah. Anyway, hopefully you downloaded the PowerPoint. For some reason, I couldn't put the PowerPoint up at my website this morning. I have no idea why. I have to fix that. But so read some books. Take your time. Don't worry about it. Like I said, you're right, they're wrong. And it's kind of nice to know that you're right, they're wrong. Sure, John.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
So I just finished John Walton's book, The Lost World of Adam and Eve.
All right, what's his perspective?
So he takes there's a lot. It was like a fire hose, right? But one of the things that he talks about is this concept that, sometimes I think it's consistent with what you're saying, is that we make the Bible into something that it's not meant to be. And so he takes a look at it from a literary perspective, I think.
Okay, good.
But then also he talks